Iran's president repeats calls for guarantees from the U.S. to revive the JCPOA as he leaves Tehran for New York to take part in a U.N. General Assembly meeting. The U.S. Central Command says the military's Green Village base in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. Also in the headline, China reacting to the U.S. president's latest comments on Taiwan. It says it will take all necessary measures in response to activities that have split the nation. This is World News, a live broadcast from Tehran. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Top story this hour, Iranian president says that he will use his visit to the U.S. to attend the U.N. General Assembly to openly defend the rights of the Iranian nation and highlight acts of oppression against it. Ibrahim Raisi also stressed that no meetings with U.S. officials will take place during the visit. This is the first time that Raisi will be attending the U.N. annual gathering. Earlier this week, he told CBS News that Iran cannot trust the U.S. with what it called meaningless promises on the nuclear deal. Raisi says that Tehran is serious about reviving the 2015 agreement, but he noted that this will hinge on Washington's offering relevant guarantees not to follow suit and former President Trump to withdraw from the accord. Now, I ask journalist and political analyst Elijah Magni about the importance of Raisi's visit to New York for the UN General Assembly meeting, and here's what he had to tell us.
Importance of this visit, it comes just a few days after the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, where the representative of half of the world were in one room, and Iran had become an official part of the organization that calls also to end the U.S. unilateralism over the world. And President Raisi is in a position today to criticize again the U.S. unilateral and illegal sanctions on the Iranian population, which is the right of Iran to live in dignity without being under the harsh sanctions imposed by the U.S. So it is an opportunity for Iran to slam the U.S. sanctions again and also to show to the world that it's possible to survive without the U.S. hegemony, even with a very harsh U.S. sanction.
Iran reacted to the border clashes that erupted between Armenia and the Azerbaijan Republic last week. Tehran urges the two sides to settle their dispute through dialogue. Foreign Ministry spokesman says the two countries should show political will for talks and use regional frameworks to put an end to the tension. Nasser Kanani says Tehran is ready to help with a diplomatic process. The official also stressed Iran's opposition to any change to geographical boundaries in the region. Deadly clashes flared in several border areas between Azerbaijan and Armenia last week before a fragile truce took hold Tuesday. The tensions are rooted in a border corridor that Baku is planning through southern Armenia to an Azerbaijani exclave. Yerevan says the corridor is against the terms of the 2020 truce that ended the bloody Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. A U.S. military base in Syria has come under a rocket attack hours after unconfirmed reports of a similar strike on another installation housing American forces. The U.S. Central Command says it's investigating the latest attack that hit the Green Village base in the northeast. It claims that rockets failed to hit any U.S. forces or equipment. An attack on the same base last month injured one U.S. military personnel. The U.S. military has refused to withdraw from Syria, even after the country won the war against Daesh terrorists. Washington deploys some 900 troopers in an oil-rich area in eastern Syria. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, has provided us with some more details about the recent rocket attack on the U.S. base in Syria.
According to local sources, eyewitnesses, and some various media outlets, there has been an attack on a U.S. occupation base in Deir ez-Zor countryside. That base positioned or situated inside Al-Umar oil field. This is one of the largest Syrian oil fields in that area. And also, this is one of the largest U.S. bases of occupation inside Syria. Now, this is not the first time this particular base is targeted. What happened, according to eyewitnesses, was that sounds of explosions were heard over there. Smoke was seen. Also, ambulance vehicles were heard rushing to the area. And some U.S. helicopters were on some reconnaissance following. Important to say that there is no claim of responsibility over who is behind this attack, but this is not the first one. In the past month, such attacks increased on various U.S. forces of occupation locations in that area of Syria.
Palestinian schools in the occupied al-Quds have started a day-long massive strike protesting Israel's attempts to distort their textbooks. Palestinian National and Islamic Forces, that's a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not a distorted one. The group also called on the international institutions to press the Tel Aviv regime not to interfere in the affairs of the Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decried Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted slogans such as no to the distorted curriculum and no to Judaizing education. The Palestinians say the regime is trying to deny students their rights to learn their own history and culture. The coffin of Queen Elizabeth II leaves the iconic Westminster Abbey in the British capital after her state funeral attended by leaders and representatives of different countries. The Queen will be laid to rest alongside her late husband, Prince Philip, during a private service and burial after 10 days of mourning. Tens of thousands of people have traveled to London for the state funeral and burial service that's being broadcast live. Monday has already been declared a public holiday. Thousands of people have packed onto the streets to file past the Queen's coffin. The final ritual will also be screened to crowds in parks and public space in the UK and across the world. Elizabeth died on September 8th at the age of 96 after reigning more than 70 years as Britain's monarch. Well, we're early joined by our London correspondent, Said Purza, who briefed us on who are attending a state funeral for the British Queen and who are not part of that event.
Some 500 dignitaries from around the world are in attendance, among them emperors, kings, queens, presidents, prime ministers, ministers, all there to bid farewell to the late monarch Queen Elizabeth II. Among those who aren't attending, notably the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who had to miss the state funeral, the reason being that there were protests over the weekend outside the Saudi embassy in London for a couple of reasons. Number one, the continuing story that haunts the Saudi Crown Prince, and that is, according to U.S. intelligence, his involvement, his order to brutally murder the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi around 4 years ago, and the Saudi involvement in the besieging and the war that has been going on against the people of Yemen over the past 5 years that has led to the deaths of more than 177,000 people.
Well, I've also talked to political analyst John Bossage about Queen Elizabeth's legacy and the people's perception of the British monarchy. Let's take a listen.
The Queen had a function. She served the function because that was a constitutional function of the state of England. That function is an anachronism. It's out of date. The people of England have left the EU. They're standing by themselves now. And now they have to determine their future. All of these expenses around the monarchy and the expenses around keeping up the pomp and circumstance are at a big divergence from the problem of England having fuel to heat itself this coming winter. This is the reality. There is no money to go around to create these false illusions of an empire that no longer exists. And average English people know this, and the vast majority knows it. And their respect for King Charles III is minimal. And we say, you know, using the old Latin saying, nomen est omen, the name is an omen of the future. I have no idea why Charles picked of his four or five names that he could pick to rule under, why he picked the name of the one English king who was beheaded, Charles I. It's a bad omen. His kingship will be short, and perhaps his sons won't ever sit on any throne.
Well, another news, Beijing deploring comments by U.S. President Biden that his forces will defend Taiwan in case of what he called a Chinese invasion of that island. The foreign ministry says that China firmly opposes U.S. stance and has launched solemn representations. The ministry says that Beijing reserves the right to take all necessary measures in response to separatist activities. China considers Taiwan part of its territory. It's been locked in tensions with the U.S. over the issue. Tensions have soared after visits by U.S. House Speaker and other American lawmakers to Taiwan in August. China has conducted several large-scale military exercises around the island following the visits. The United States is heaping up pressure on Russia on all fronts, from economic sanctions to domestic restrictions. But the White House has gone a step further by telling South Africa not to associate with Russia at all. Now, the South African president has hit back. He says it's not for Washington to decide who his country can do or cannot do business with. The move may further alienate the U.S. when it comes to Africa as a whole.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. You said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when the UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend US interests in Africa, stating that US intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as a foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the UN. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
Well, as regards investment in Africa, China tops the list of foreign countries. A conservative estimate puts China's investments at $126 billion from 2001 to 2018, and that figure has increased even further since then. Russia comes in at $20 billion a year, while the U.S. invested almost $45 billion in 2020. Now, Washington's incoherent policy vis-a-vis Africa may be the reason why it's fallen behind. Let's now take a look at Ukraine now. The country is claiming its troops have advanced to the Oskil River, threatening Russian forces stationed in Donbass. Kiev is pushing ahead toward a counteroffensive in the northeastern Kharkiv region. According to the military, the operation has led to the liberation of thousands of square kilometers of Ukrainian territory. President Zelensky promised that there will be no let-up in fighting to regain areas lost to Russia. He has stressed that they will keep up the pressure. He says the whole Ukrainian territory must be liberated. Meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has placed support for Ukraine for as long as it takes to push Russian forces out of the country. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. With regards to achievements, I believe the most important thing this government has achieved is that it has revived hope and trust in people. In some cases, these efforts have also had tangible results that the people have witnessed themselves. For example, improvements in the health sector, diplomacy, and some cultural sectors have shown clear, distinct results. Some of these have achieved results, therefore people need to be shown these results. There have been results, but people need to be told about the results and the outcomes. In some cases, the efforts have made not yet come to fruition. However, it can be sensed that work is being done. To me, these things are your greatest accomplishments.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, One of the other accomplishments you've made may be seen in your provisional trips. These are truly brilliant. It is a very important matter that this administration has made 31 trips to various points across the country in just 11 months. Two deprived and remote areas and some rare things have taken place, and a deep empathy has been shown towards the people. Their problems have been mentioned and assessed in the field. This is a very important, and I shall talk about this again in the recommendations I will make that are associated with this matter. One of the other achievements you've made has been your quick response when dealing with unforeseen events such as floods and other disasters that have taken place. This speed in your actions is very important. This is of great value that an official rushes immediately to the scene whenever there is an earthquake or a flood somewhere, and they monitor and organize the relief work that needs to be carried out there.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including two children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. And the weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the U.S., U.K., Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staffed by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The Ukraine's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they are fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nusayr Square massacre. The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, after a truce, has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, in which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said. The renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his high-ranking diplomatic and economic delegation has visited Uzbekistan on an official visit. The aim of the visit was to expand bilateral ties with Uzbekistan. Iran and Uzbekistan signed a total of 17 memoranda of understanding that the two countries would boost their cooperation in the fields of trade, cargo transit, cultural exchanges, health and custom issues, among others. Another important aim of President Raisi's trip was Iran's further integration into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has held signing a memorandum of commitments to join the SCO. The announcement was made by Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying the delegation on the visit to the city of Samarkand, which is hosting a summit of the SCO. It means that Tehran has now entered a new stage of diverse economic, commercial, transit, energy, and other cooperation with the member states of the regional body. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was founded by China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in 2001.
Whereas Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about exactly what it says. I mean, it's about countries cooperating in the sphere of economic issues, but also security. And if we look, what are the benefits for Iran? Well, I mean, there are a number of benefits within the sphere of economics and security. The hard security. Because, I mean, Iran has been subjected to decades now of economic coercion and threat of military action by a US unipolar world, which has been using its institutions to coerce and squeeze Iran.
It's currently the world's biggest regional market, with 8 official members and 3 observer states. Iran and the organization started a formal process for Tehran's accession to the bloc in March. Its membership was later approved by the Iranian administration. Despite the US-led efforts to isolate Iran over the past decades, Tehran's diplomatic weight in regional bodies is now growing. Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will give it economic and political room to further integrate into the non-Western-led bloc.
This is a possibility for Iran to develop cooperation in such things as economic matters with other countries in the non-Western world. This is equally true for the large countries such as Russia or China, where such an arrangement, it's beneficial for everyone. It's a reciprocal exchange. It's not a one-way exchange. And so I think in this regard, Iran, with its location and with its resources, is a very useful addition.
Iran has also applied to join BRICS, a group consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This forum represents 40% of the world's population and 26% of the world's economy. Ultimately, BRICS could become a club of the world's largest energy producers and consumers outside the United States. Iran holds the world's second largest gas reserve, and its membership in BRICS would result in added value for both sides. Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to U.S. attempts to isolate Iran. It's believed that Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its role in the BRICS Plus economic mechanism have both made Iran a partner in international macro decision-making and in the political, security and economic fields.
And what happens here, it provides possibilities to create meaningful cooperative relationships with countries of the non-Western order. And this is the order that is rising. We can see lately too, Iran has not been the only one under pressure, but India as well for its independent position on Ukraine. So, these Western institutions are just absolutely part of their foreign policy agenda, which is to maintain US hegemony at all costs.
It will also elevate the position of the multilateralist front in the international calculations. Tehran, for a long time, has called for the pro-multilateralism front to establish and promote independent financial, economic, political, and cultural mechanisms in order to make a smooth transition from the current unilateral U.S.-led world order to a multilateral one.
When it comes to Iran, Israel has never refrained from relaying its sentiment, especially when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. It has always maintained that Iran is after weaponizing its nuclear program, and it has gone out of its way to provide the IAEA and the US with fabricated evidence to prove its false claim. But Israel may have stepped too far in its latest claim against Iran and the JCPOA sanctions removal talks. The head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, said the revival of a nuclear deal with world powers will not give Iran immunity from Israeli operations. This is a fully loaded statement, which, if taken a look at closely, actually proves that Israel has executed destructive and lethal acts against Iran, including sabotaging its nuclear program, destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, to name a few. David Bernier, in his first speech since becoming Mossad's chief, has said, "We won't take part in this charade. Even if a deal is signed, it will not provide immunity from Mossad operations." Even though Israel has never admitted to acting against Iran, this can be interpreted that the opposite is true. Iran's response to these statements were to the point. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said, "We do not expect a terrorist regime anything other than terrorist actions." Some Israeli acts of terrorism against Iran include the assassination of four nuclear scientists and damaging Iran's nuclear facility in Karaj. Now, the question is, will the international community react to this, or will it wait until Israel commits another act of violence or terrorism against Iran?
Israel is a rogue nation. It is a terrorist nation. It will not adhere to international law. It will not respect international law. The fact that it has been working against Iran, assassinating scientists and other means against Iran, just indicates that it is a rogue nation. That if the JCPOA should be resurrected, Israel will not respect Iran's borders as it has not in the past. We have to remember that Israel has been has violated international law repeatedly, not only in Palestine, Iran, but Syria and Lebanon. Israel has no regard for international law, has no regard for human rights. So these statements by the Mossad chief are just consistent with Israel's criminal activities.
Talks between Iran and the world powers on its civilian nuclear program have progressed to the point where the impasse may have been resolved towards reaching a solution. That is one of the reasons Israel has reacted by publicly stating it would not stop from executing acts against Iran. And its moves in that regard have been in overdrive. On the surface, Israeli moves to undermine the deal appears to have worked. Israel announced that it does not believe that Iran and world powers will return to their nuclear deal before the November midterm elections. And even though it looked like a deal was on the horizon, the IAEA repeated its old accusations of wanting an explanation on traces of uranium. A quarterly report by the nuclear watchdog on Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, accused Iran to have continued enrichment beyond limits in the agreement, even though Iran has demonstrated maximum transparency. But these negative reports on Iran may be political in nature. The U.S. administration and President Joe Biden may not want to jeopardize the chances for his party winning the midterm elections. Israel's Prime Minister Yair Lapid is also dealing with elections in Israel, and a deal may ruin his prospects. For now, the JCPOA survival talks has slipped back into the intensive care unit, and its chances for success appear dim.
Israel is certainly overstepping its bounds. It has no right to say that it's going to assault another nation, that it's going to ignore an agreement that... or it's going to violate an agreement that it isn't a party to, that it is trying to sabotage that agreement, which hasn't even been made yet. It is, as I mentioned before, Israel is a rogue nation, doesn't respect international law. Now, the JCPOA signed a number of years ago between European nations, the United States, and Russia, and it was the United States that violated it. The Israeli government has been opposed to it from the start and continues to be opposed to it. We have to remember, Israel is a nuclear-armed nation. It and the United States have no right to say what other countries will or will not have nuclear weapons. Now, I personally believe that the fewer nuclear weapons there are in the world, the better it is. But if Iran is being threatened by two nuclear-armed countries, it must defend itself and defend its people. But Israel, to get back to your point, is certainly overstepping its bounds. It is certainly fomenting problems within the Middle East when there don't need to be these particular problems. But this is typical of the behaviors of a terrorist nation, and that is what Israel is. It does certainly threaten its own so-called security by threatening basically war against another powerful nation. So it is doing itself no favors, but to be protected by the United States in all things, so it continues with its crimes and its threatened crimes throughout the Middle East.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution of Iran. We all should know that it is these political religious ceremonies that give Muslims, particularly the Shia Muslims, these followers of the infallible Imams, the unity they should enjoy. These also preserve the nationality of all Muslims. Islam or Islamic government is a divine phenomenon, the implementation of which guarantees the happiness of its followers in this world and the hereafter in the best possible way, and has the potential to eliminate tyranny, corruption, and transgression, and leading humankind to its ultimate desired goal.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the resurrection and the hereafter. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini, he says that in this world, the manifestation of intercession of the intercessors is their guidance. In that world, the essence of guidance is the intercession. If you did not benefit from their guidance, you shall receive no intercession. To the extent you receive guidance, you'll receive intercession. Now, this is very important that we must know that Imam Khomeini was a mystic, an arif. And the thing that he has just said, which we just quoted, is one of the key points which Arafa does understand from the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, the ma'rifa, the knowledge that they had towards the Ahlul Bayt. And Imam Khomeini is saying that we all want the intercession of Ahlul Bayt. We need their shafa'a. But their shafa'at or intercession is in the guidance which they have provided. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, he said that, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى. He said to his prophet that, oh prophet, tell them that if they want to give the reward, it is the love of Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because there are two things in loving someone. Number one, when we love someone, we hate their enemies. And this is for sure. If I love my father, I hate his enemies. If I love my children, those who hurt my children, I hate them. So this is the first key point, that when we love Ahlul Bayt, we hate their enemies, which means that the love of Ahlul Bayt is the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, we hate the enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The second thing is, when we love someone, we obey them. For example, if we take the example of this word, this material world where we see two people loving each other. For example, if the girl is saying, for example, to the husband or the one who loves her, that the crows are white, he will believe in it, that the crows are white. This is what the love does. If the person whom we love, he does not like or she does not like our hairstyle, we change our hairstyle, we change our clothing, we change our way of walking and talking. Why? Because we love them. We want to obey. This obedience is in the love. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made the love of Ahlul Bayt an obligation, so that on the first step, we will hate their enemies, who are the enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. On the second step, when we obey them, we are obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, this program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, how the story of Karbala and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, unites the people of the Indian subcontinent. And we will see how India buying oil from Russia may affect the foreign policy and economy of this country.
Every year, at an event known as the largest annual gathering in the world, several million people gather together in Iraq for Arbaeen, the 40th day of the tragedy of Karbala, when Imam Hussein, the grandson of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam, peace be upon them, was martyred with his companions and family members. Arbaeen processions send a message of justice, faith and unity. The commemoration extends beyond any religion and is engaged in by all those who believe in humanity.
Arbaeen marks the culmination of the 40-day period of mourning after the tragedy of Karbala, which happened on 10th Muharram in the Islamic calendar. The event marks a heroic battle of good versus evil, justice against injustice, where the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, his 72 companions and family members showed strength and determination against the forces of Yazid, the tyrannical ruler who established his position at the helm by virtue of the sword rather than the word. Yazid ibn Muawiyah's forces brutally and mercilessly slayed the innocent followers of justice after keeping them thirsty for 3 days. This act of heroism attracts millions of people from around the world, even after 1,400 years, to come together and commemorate this event in large processions as a sign of remembrance and protest under the banner of equity and justice against tyranny and oppression. According to Forbes, over 40 million people participated in Arbaeen pilgrimage in 2016, and the number keeps growing every year. These people mainly walk the whole 45 miles from the city of Najaf to the city of Karbala, and on their way, the pilgrims are served with not only food, shelter, and water, but are even provided medical services and security.
The War of Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them, who stood up against a tyrannical ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, is believed to transcend all cultural boundaries and be a symbol of universal freedom, compassion, and social justice. The struggle of Imam Hussein and his companions against injustice and their sacrifice in Karbala is not only an example of humanity at its best, but represents a chance for the diverse people of the subcontinent to unite and come together in a struggle for justice.
The people of the subcontinent religiously participate in the holy activities of Muharram, including the Ashura processions. Those who cannot go directly to Karbala participate in local processions, which happen all across the globe on the 10th of Muharram and 40 days after. These huge rallies include hundreds of thousands of people at any one time, and even millions in some instances. In India, although most processions are allowed, some of the main Muharram processions have been banned by the government since 1989. But believers prepare for the ritual every year nonetheless. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, the processions are often attacked by the Indian police, as Kashmiris often use Muharram processions as an inspiration to protest against the oppression perpetrated by the Indian government. In Pakistan, Muslims organize and participate in processions, but the threat of attacks from extremists looms over the faithful. Therefore, the processions are held under tight security. This is because of bomb blasts and suicide attacks that mark Pakistani Shia gatherings every year. And although the attacks have decreased, it is estimated that in Pakistan, over 23,000 Shia Muslims have been killed since 1963. The killings were once so rampant that some researchers describe it as genocide.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sayyed Salman Naghavi. He's an Islamic scholar from Pakistan, currently residing in Rome. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Naghavi. Now, the story of Karbala brings people of diverse faiths together against injustice. Now, how do you think this can unite minorities of India against injustice, seeing that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein and his companions in Karbala is mourned not just by Muslims, but by Hindus and Christians as well?
Yes, in the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being, the message of Mahathir alayhi salam is listened. It has a global appeal because the mission of Imam Hussein was to stand up against injustice and tyranny and corruption. And basically, the underpinning ideology of Imam Hussein's movement was based on the fact that he was fighting for the cause of mankind and for providing it competent and worthy leadership. And therefore, the issue that all of mankind faces today is the imposition of the hegemonic rule of people who are not competent, not worthy. They are deprived of basic moral values and principles. And they want to create a world order in which they are at the head of and at the head of all the affairs of the of mankind, and wherever we have injustice and wherever we have tyranny, where we the Muslims or mankind in general faces oppression at the hands of people who are not worthy of ruling other people, they are not competent. They do not have moral and ideological beliefs which can make them serve mankind for the sake of mankind. We have a problem, and that is why Imam Hussein stood up against that corrupt regime.
Mr. Naghavi, the Arabian processions have been held worldwide on a massive scale, but why is the media coverage so limited or non-existent in some outlets?
Yes, I think that because the global hegemony in the media is of the Zionists, and they do not want us to lay the ground for a movement against that hegemonistic oppression they are perpetrating all over the world. So they would not like us, like the world, to understand that such a movement is growing day by day, every year. You look, the Pakistanis coming from Pakistan, they are increasing every year. The biggest movement of mankind, Pakistanis, subcontinent people, they are becoming a part of it, despite the floods, despite so many problems that the Pakistanis are facing, just because of that. Now, those who are, they are oppressing us, they are perpetrating that tyrannical global hegemony. They don't want people of the world to realize that such an awakening is being created, which may turn against them. They may have issues which I think they need to cover up today. They need to hide this truth, that this may be a ritualistic movement today, but tomorrow it will turn up into a grand revolution against the oppressive regimes and the corrupt regimes of the world. Today, we in Pakistan or in the subcontinent are facing the consequences of global warming. And Pakistan or the subcontinent has a very small impact in that. 1% of the impact is from Pakistan, but it is facing 10% of the consequences, the calamities, the floods. And this is because of the injustice which is taking place in the world. So this movement for Imam Hussein, it may be just a mourning ceremony for Imam Hussein and the Arba'een, but it will change into something global, universal, which has an appeal for the world. Today, even in the West, everyone there knows that 1% of the population is ruling over the 99%. So if they understand that Imam Hussein is calling us.
So, Mr. Naqvi, why is it that the Indian or in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the Indian government meddles in the religious affairs of its Muslim population?
We all know that in Kashmir, the people of Kashmir, the Muslims of Kashmir, whether Shias or the Sunnis, they have been oppressed, they have been deprived of their rights, they want freedom from India, they want to be independent, or they want to have freedom from India.